Of interview with W. Dahanayake, 30th of June 1967.
How it is recorded?
Pera sabdana karo I mewa I te gain on again, hande kaata tin din ne pa katha karana. Yes, doctor.
I was wondering what made you take an interest in politics in the late 30s, I presume, early 40s?
Well, I suppose the answer that I should give to you is that it came naturally to me. Even at school, I was interested in public questions. And I remember that I took part when very young in debates in the school literary association or the debating society. And the subjects which I chose to speak on were those of public interest. So that I can say that politics came naturally to me. Then when I was quite young, I found myself on the public platform. You see, I can't say that I selected politics of my own free choice. I would rather say that it came so naturally to me that I could not resist its call.
I was wondering whether any particular books or the example of the Indian nationalist movement or something like that also inspired you.
At that time, you see, I was born in 1902, so that during my very impressionable years, we had the riots of 1915, the First World War of 1914, and the birth of the Ceylon National Congress somewhere about 1918, when Sir James Peerage, Sir Ponnambalam Arunachalam, Steadfast Tenanayake, and so many other Ceylonese leaders were just coming out and beginning to speak of self-government. This of course also synchronized with the birth of new ideas in India. The age of Gandhi was beginning, and we used to read such a lot about the great Indian leaders like Motilal Nehru and the generation that went before Gandhi and Jawaharlal, so that our heads used to be full of national ideas, and even locally I remember certain things created a very deep impression in my mind. There was a Sinhalese dramatist by the name of John De Silva who brought out certain Sinhalese dramas which were shown for the first time in the Tower Hall, Colombo. They were shown right from the island, and these caught on very rapidly, and they were shown right from the island. Dramas, theatrical dramas like C.V. Sangabo, Raj Singh, Sakuntala, all of which breathed patriotism. So that I think personally that John De Silva, the dramatist, played a great part in reawakening political consciousness in this country. At the same time, about this period, when I was in my teens, there was another great figure in our midst. That was Anagarika Dharmapada. He was going all out against foreign ways, foreign customs. He was preaching against, not merely against a foreign religion, but he was preaching against the people of Ceylon becoming westernized.
But what sort of impact did he have in the villagers and among the lower classes in the towns?
Who, you mean men like Dharmapada?
Dharmapada.
They created a very deep impression in the minds of the people. For instance, I would say that right about this time, most people, most Sinhalese people started giving their children Sinhalese names. The majority of people used to call their children by English names. But about this time, say between about 1910 and 1920, just everybody started giving his child a Sinhalese name. Of course, this movement had started even earlier than 1915. Earlier than 1915, there had been Ikkadu Sri Sumangala and Gunananda and certain other reformers, including Colonel Olcott, who came and established in Ceylon the Buddhist schools, Ananda, Mahinda and Dhanaraja. But during the time that I was a boy at school, there was this big national movement in Ceylon. Just another thing which I forgot to mention to you was that about this time there was also the so-called temperance movement.
So-called
temperance movement headed by Mr. F. R. Sen and I. There, that temperance movement, the aim of that temperance movement was to close the taverns. To close down the existing taverns.
Yes.
They carried on a campaign to close down the existing taverns, the Toddy and Arak taverns, through a poll, a local option poll. And there used to be public meetings and everybody was interested in this new movement and they got together and asked for a poll to close down an existing tavern and succeeded invariably in getting it closed. This also happened about the same period. Now this was known as the temperance movement, although it was more a prohibition movement than a temperance movement. That's why I used the word so-called temperance movement.
No, I was wondering whether you were referring to the theory that some of the people who were behind it were trying to undermine the Karavas who were profiting from the tavern trade.
I don't think that there was any such motive. The leaders of the temperance movement, men like F.R. Senanayake and D.B. Jayatilaka, were above that type of motive use. They were quite sincere when they said that drink was doing evil in the country and it should be stopped. At that time there existed, of course, a very large number of taverns. Today we have only a very few of them. For instance, today between Aluthukkama and Gaul, there is not a single tavern. You find a tavern in Aluthukkama and the next tavern is at Kattugoda, just on the outskirts of Goa. So that whole gap of 35 miles, you find no tavern. Then when you start from Gaul again, there is no tavern in between Gaul and Initigala, that's in the outskirts of Gaul, and Ambattur. You see, so that temperance movement led to the closure of a very large number of taverns in the country. I do not know whether it led to a lessening of the evil of drink. But anyway, this movement, this temperance movement, was closely allied to the national movement. I also remember, Doctor, very vividly, the first National Day celebration held in Ceylon. The first National Day celebration, which are now a regular feature of our life, in April of each year, you find National Day celebrations right around the country in April of this year. The first of its kind was held on the Gaul Esplanade, either in 1915 or 14 or 1916. I was a little fellow who watched that, the first National Day celebration. The celebrations were presided over by Dr. Paul E. Pierce, who was at that time police magistrate Gaul. Now, Dr. Paul E. Peeris was at that time a great hero among nationalists. He had got into the civil service and he was a great scholar and student who delved deep into history and archaeology. And he was, round about that time, the magistrate at, either the magistrate or the district judge at Gampala. In 1915, there was a disturbance in Gampala between the Sinhalese and the Muslims. The cause of that disturbance was a right of way for a Buddhist procession which went tom-toming along a street, passing a street which had a mosque, the Gampala mosque.
And Paul E. Peeris gave a decision.
Yes, now this went up to the courts and Paul E. Peeris gave a very historic decision. That is one of the most remarkable judgments that any person has written in Ceylon. Perhaps you may be able to read it in...
I have read the portions of it.
You find it in the memoirs of Dr. Paul E. Peeris. You will find it in your own library. Now he gave this judgment. When he gave this judgment, the government was displeased with him. And they sent him away from Gampala to Gaul. And there was a talk that they would be taking up the matter in the Privy Council, but I think they settled it in some amicable way. Well, Dr. Paul E. Peeris was a nationalist. And he presided at these National Day celebrations in 1915. Then I was only 30. Now you ask me how it is that I began to take an interest in politics. It so happened while I had a natural inclination for politics, that what was taking place in the country at that time made a person feel nationalistic and patriotic. I think that quite a large number of youths of that decade became a good public men afterwards.
What was the language you spoke at home in your teenage days, both Sinhalese and English?
Both Sinhalese and English. And with the parents in Sinhalese, amongst ourselves children, we used English. With the parents and others in Sinhalese, amongst children, we spoke more in English than in Sinhalese.
If I may ask, what economic strata did you emerge from?
From the middle class.
Did you feel that some of our leaders were sort of upper middle class or even very wealthy and far too close to the British, capitalistic in approach and insufficient militant in their demand?
I don't think at that time we had that feeling. We had no feeling against capitalists as such. I think the feeling that was uppermost in our mind was that we were against a foreigner ruling us. That was about all. That was the main idea that was working in our mind was, why should a foreigner rule over us? We should rule ourselves. We had no anti-capitalistic ideas at that time. I don't think we had that. But of course, these anti-capitalistic ideas came somewhere in the 30s with the emergence of the Lanka Samasamaj Party.
I believe you joined the party.
Yes, I was in the party. From its inception somewhere in the 30s. That was just before the Samasamaj movement. There was what is called the Suryamal movement.
Yes, I know.
Suryamal movement. That came after the First World War. Every year after the First World War, after 1919, poppies used to be sold in the streets. Then a rival movement was started to sell Suryamal for the upliftment of our country. So we sold the Suryamal on the same day that poppies were sold. That's the Suryamal movement. From the Suryamal movement, we stepped on to the Samsamaj.
You said we. Were you in a youth league in Goa?
No, there we had an organization. We hadn't organized ourselves, but scattered in a scattered manner, youths right around the country were of the same view, and they, in some way or other, joined the Samasamaj.
What made you join the Samasamaj political party at that stage?
Merely to fight against the foreign rule that was in the country. We were fighting against the foreigners. We were fighting against what used to have began to be called imperialism. But at that time, we were really fighting against the foreign yoke that we had in the country. That was all.
And then in your mind, you were not at the same time thinking of altering the economic structure of the island?
No, no, no. Those ideas had not come to us at that time. Say in the 20s, those ideas were not uppermost in our minds.
No, I was thinking of the late 30s when you joined the party.
In the late 30s, of course, with the dissemination of knowledge, more knowledge and more political knowledge, then we began to think in terms of the exploiters and the exploited, the imperialists and the colonial people who have been trampled upon. But at the beginning, I will say that those thoughts came to our mind somewhere round about the late 20s and the 30s. But those were not the thoughts in our minds in the between 1910 and 1920.
Mm-hmm. When did you enter the state council, sir?
Very much late. I entered the state council in 1943.
That's for Bibile.
Yes. That was in the days of what is called the Long Parliament. That parliament had been, that state council had been elected in 1936, and the war broke out in 1939, World War II. So that because the war was going on, they extended the life of the state council from year to year. Then I came in on the seventh year. Well, eventually the state council was dissolved in 1947, I think. 1947 or 1948. That's the longest state council we ever had.
Did you come forward as a Samasamajit or as an independent?
Independent. At that time there was no party system. 1943 there was really no party system. I contested a by-election.
Yes, could you tell me something about the campaigning of that era? What form did it take? How did you conduct your campaign?
Purely as a reformer. As a reformer who showed to the people that the way the government was going on was wrong, and that greater benefits could accrue to the people, and that more should be done for the people. Our line was the line of a reformist. We had nothing radical in our views. I don't think I even put forward, say, the idea of independence in my campaign in 1943. I inveighed against the existing state of affairs and said, you can hope for a better time, send a better man. We had no party system at that time.
How did you campaign? Was your emphasis on house-to-house campaigning or on public speaking?
House to house was campaigning was not possible in a place like Bibile. The Bibile seat of 1943 comprised of about three or four seats of today: Monaragala, Puttala, Bibile, Passara, Mayangal. So that the Bibile electorate was very, very large, and it is sparsely populated. A portion of it is the Vedda country. Sometimes you have got to travel for 20 or 30 miles till you come to some type of human habitation. So there was no house-to-house canvas. I had to organize meetings and speak to little groups of people. And if I had 100 to 200, a crowd of 100 to 200 I thought that that was a big meeting. Eventually, I lost the election by 400 votes in a poll, of about 5,000, if I remember right. And in the next by-election, I won by another 400, also in a poll of about 5,000.
Oh, so you came forward in 36 also?
No, no.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
I came forward in 43 and lost the seat to Mr. Simon Pierce. Then I filed an election petition against him because he held a government contract at the time that he contested the seat. Then he gave up the government contract. He lost the election petition. He was allowed to come forward again if he gave up his government contract. Then I fought a second time, the same year, after the election petition. That on the second occasion, I beat him.
What made the difference?
Well, you see, a little more brisk work by me. And the people also realized. I think they sort of, I had captured their imagination. So although I was a complete stranger, they voted for me.
He was from that area?
He was a big shot in the area. He was the managing director of the bus company that lies in that particular area. So that I was up against a tough guy, as they would say.
So in that sense, he would have had advantages over you in the transport at his command?
Oh yes, he had. I had no transport. But of course, transport was not such an so very useful in that electorate. Because voters had sometimes to walk 10 and 20 miles to get to their polling booths.
How about the position of an influence of the headman? Did they work for you or against you? How much did they influence the people?
You see, the village headman of that, of the 40s and the 50s, undoubtedly exercised influence. The people were afraid of it. People were afraid to do anything against the village headman. So therefore, if the village headman took a side, a good percentage of the village took the same side. I think it was the fear that was in the minds of the people that made them do so. Although there were reasons why they should have hated the headman, still, I think a greater number of people at that time feared the village headman. For one reason, of course, the village headman was the only representative of the government in their own locality, in their village. So that if a villager needed anything from the government, any help from the government, the lease of a land, or any type of help, that help would come through the village headman. So the village headman had a big say in the matters of the village. He could put a man in trouble, he could help a man.
Yes.
And so, naturally, the people feared the village headman.
But with the secret ballot?
Yes, when the secret ballot came on in the 30s, still the village headman exercised influence. I believe they must have exercised influence till about the 50s. In the 50s?
What about their influence on the question of registration? Couldn't they favor one candidate by the way they registered the voters?
Originally, of course, the property qualification. But after the Dunamo system of government, we had adult franchise. And in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, the village headman did not delete names or insert false names. This, what you are referring to now, is a new disease that has come up in the 60s, where the gramasev, who has taken the place of the village headman, doctors the list by deleting those who are known to be the supporters of one side, and by inserting a large number of false names or duplication of or duplicating names of those who favor a particular side. This is a disease that has sprung up in the 60s. It's a new disease. You did not find this in the 50s.
This Gramsekhar, have you caught some out doing this?
Oh yes. I can't give you the numbers offhand.
Yes.
Now, we have, in my capacity as Minister of Home Affairs, I have given directions that there should be the strictest supervision and action whenever any misdemeanor is detected. Now there are cases which have arisen in those electorates where by-elections were held, in which voters have come forward and pointed out that in a particular ward such and such names had been deleted deliberately by the Gram Sevak, or such and such names had been duplicated. Whenever such complaints come up, they are inquired into by a staff officer, and if the case is proved, the Gram Sevak is dismissed. There have been a number of dismissals recently, and some of the inquiries are still pending. In reference to the recent by-elections.
Are these dismissals only with reference to the by-elections or also with reference to the 65 general elections?
These inquiries deal with complaints that are made to us.
Mm-hmm.
Because we are not carrying out an investigation on our own. Whenever a complaint is made to us, we inquire into it. So that the normal complaint that comes to us is in regard to the current list of voters, because I suppose nobody would go to the extent of delving into past lists and bringing out cases of irregularity, because it may be that the Gram Sevak concerned is not there for you to punish. It is in reference to the current lists of voters that the complaints keep on coming. Duplication of names, and sometimes the same name repeated thrice, in different wards, or in different electoral area, in the same electorate.
But, of course, this can prevent the damage being done in the case of the by-election. In the sense that it was after...
I would be wary about speaking of the by-elections.
Mm-hmm.
Doctor, the position is that there are many factors which influence voters in the by-election. Certainly the manipulation of voters' lists has had a bad effect, or rather an adverse effect on the government. That is, there is no doubt about it. And perhaps, if the list had not been doctored in that way, we might have been able to win one or two of the by-elections which we lost. But there were other factors, Doctor, which were at work in the recent by-elections.
What would you say they were?
For instance, I found that the traders who had been with the UNP and with the national government in March 1965, and who had worked very hard for us, had lost confidence in the government during the past 2 years. Either they were not so enthusiastic as they had been before, or some of them positively did harm to the cause of the government in the various by-elections. So we had lost the traders. See, the government had lost some of its friends.
Why? Why did they lose confidence?
You see, the government, once it started ruling the country, was not able to deliver the goods in the fashion in which the people expected you to deliver the goods. For instance, when the SLFP government was in power, Mrs. Sirima Bandaranaike became very unpopular with the trade, because the Sirima government started nationalizing the trade. For instance, they took over the trade in dried fish. The trade in dried fish was in the hands of private individuals, both local and foreign. And the Sirima government completely eliminated the private sector in the dried fish trade and took it over to the CWV. Similarly, it followed a policy of trade through government channels. Well, this alienated the sympathies of the trade. And when the March 1965 elections came on, the traders rallied around the UNP, hoping that when the UNP came into power, it would have a different policy, an opposite policy, you see. But when the UNP came into power, the UNP found that for reasons of practical politics, if nothing else, you see, if for nothing else, reasons of practical politics, it could not completely change the policy of the Sirima government. For instance, we allowed the dried fish trade to remain in the hands of the CWU. We did not hand it back to the private trade. And the UNP government had also in its actions to do certain things which hurt the traders. So thus, you will see, doctor, that there are hopes, they built big hopes on a UNP victory. And all those hopes were blasted.
Has the UNP, or at least some members of the UNP, given any promises on this point?
I think, I talk subject to correction, because I am not a full UNPer. I think in the UNP manifesto, there was a clause which spoke of giving the private sector their due rights in the sphere of trade. Giving the private sector their due rights in the sphere of trade. During election time, the UNP speakers also attacked bitterly and strongly the CWE. The CWE had taken away the trading rights from the private sector in many fields of activity, like dried fish and various other commodities. Now, the UNP speakers attacked the CWE, and also they had this in their manifesto. So it was generally felt that when the UNP came into power, the traders would get the day. But the traders did not, and therefore they were so bitterly disappointed. They became infuriated against the UNP. Today some of them swear against the government. So that was one of the factors, in my opinion, that led to the defeats in the various by-elections.
You know,
but on the whole, I think the government did very, very low by-elections. See, with all the handicaps that we had, the government did really well.
What handicaps?
Handicaps like the voters list. We had voters list that had been manipulated. In each by-election, perhaps 1,000 to 2,000 votes lost. Then we had the traders against us. We had certain other elements like the government servants who were working against us. The majority of government servants were working against us.
Aren't the police generally on the side, supposed to be on the side of the UNP?
Well, the police try to maintain law and order, but if the police take a side openly,
that goes against the side, they take. I don't think the police take the side away from the issue. Sometimes it is found that people complain against the police. The police have a hard task in maintaining law and order. It is very difficult for the police to steer clear of charges being leveled against them by this side or the other side, that the police are partial. No, the public are not affected by the police taking a side. For instance, the police can't make a side win. The police cannot make a side lose. But the traders have made a side to lose, or have made a side to win. By the traders, I mean even the little boutiques that you find scattered in the various villages. Because the boutique really becomes the center of day-to-day propaganda. In the evening, the people meet, they go to buy their provisions. And then you hear the boutique or somebody saying, oh, we don't have this, such and such thing. That is the fault of the government. A boutique keeper says, well, yes, I can't get that. That is the fault of the government. So that is really the most powerful propaganda against the government, and it has been taking place in every little village from day to day after we came into power.
Now the SLFP speaks of being a socialist party, and they have done some, taken some steps to nationalizing aspects of the private sector. But isn't it true that many capitalist interests or many business interests are behind the SLFP?
Oh yes. I think, for instance, Sindhis and the Boras are behind the SLFP today. The Sindhis and the Boras are behind the SLFP today. The position is that people like these, the Sindhis and the Boras, were on the side of the UNP prior to 1956. Between 1956 and 1965, the period of the SLFP government, the SLFP won a good many new friends. You see, while they, on the one hand, mouthed socialism and nationalized things like insurance and the petroleum services, at the same time, the SLFP wooed the money bags, those who had the money, like the Sindhis and the Boras. I see it very clearly in something in which I am interested now as Home Minister. The SLFP government handed over a large number of industries in the period from 1960 to 1965 to foreigners, or to half foreigners. By half foreigners I mean people like the registered citizen, who work, of course, according to plan with the foreigners. Now all these registered citizens have their connections with countries outside Ceylon. They have their accounts with countries outside Ceylon. They send exchange illicitly. They are up to smuggling. Those are the people to whom a large number of industries were handed over by the SLFP government.
Industries handed over?
Why? Now, I will take this industry, the weaving industry, the textile industry. I am interested in that because the handloom textile industry is in my charge as Minister of Home Affairs. Now, besides the handloom industry, there is the howloom industry, where the looms have to be imported. The handloom industry of which I am in charge of is one in which we make the handlooms here locally, and our girls weave the cloth. Mr. Maithripala Senanayake and the ministers of the SLFP government handed over the industries connected with textile production through machinery to these foreigners. For instance, now you get rayon, various types of nylon, made in Ceylon in these industrial industrial undertaking, which are in the hands of the foreigners. Then you will also notice that wherever they gave concessions, they also gave those concessions to those big business tycoons of the port and the peta, the majority of whom are not Ceylonese by descent. Thus, in that subtle way, they won the Boras and the Sindhis, who have pots and pots of money. They do not know what they have to do with their money. They financed SLFP today. You see, they financed SLFP today. Prior to 1956, those were the people who supported the UNP. The UNP has lost their support now.
Isn't it correct to say that some groups sometimes give money to both parties?
Yes, probably, you see. That is also true in a way, because they are the practice in Ceylon is to be able to say Dinupilat Hoya. Yeah, for the winning side. Hurrah for the winning side.
Yeah.
It is a slogan that works in the minds of many businessmen. You see, they will always feel that in the event of the UNP continuing in power, they don't want to antagonize them completely. So they are maybe a sop to the UNP also. But by and large, they are supporting the SLF. They are organizing various rallies and shows, demonstrations.
What about people like the Malibans and Gunasena? They are supposed to have been...
Yes, now Malibans and Gunasena, they are people of whom I would say Dinumpila Tohoya. They follow that principle. I do not know what they are in their innermost thoughts, whether they are UNP or anti-UNP. But certainly they would like to carry on. There is not much politics in the proprietor of Maliban or the proprietors of Gunasena. They are feathering their own nest. Really feathering their own nest. They will, I suppose, as you suggested just now, they would help both sides.
Turning to the question of electioneering today, in what ways is it different from, say, your 47 campaign?
Yes, it is different today, because today party politics plays a great part. For instance, it is very difficult for an independent candidate to get a sufficiently large number of votes unless he is a man of outstanding merit and claim. You see, an independent, as a campaign proceeds, as an election campaign proceeds and opinion crystallizes in the minds of people, they begin to choose between the two contending parties, the government and the opposition. They don't like to cast their vote to an independent man because they feel that an independent man will be neither here nor there and will not be able to be of much help to them. So that is, there's a tendency amongst our people to follow rigidly the party politics. During the last, say, 20 years, that tendency has grown. Till today, you see, when we get up on a platform, we say, now, please remember that you are not voting for mistake, but you are voting for such and such a party.
Or you say that on the platform?
Yes, we say that on the platform. Please don't think that you are voting for mistake, but you are voting for such and such a party. And these are the advantages you would get if you have a representative of that party in the parliament. So party politics, the idea of party politics has grown. Although, Doctor, I do not think that party politics is the best suited to our genius or to the conditions prevailing in the country.
Why?
You see, there is such a lot of wastage of time and effort. Because in parliament, we are arranged on two sides, each fighting the other. And we cannot get through a forward policy so easily. There are difficulties, hurdles which you have to cross, parliamentary hurdles. And we have also to be thinking of satisfying the people, because the other side is always there to criticize us. Then again, besides the delays that are taking place, We find that in Pali, some really clever men are arranged on the other side. So if you could have a system in which all our resources are pooled and all our best men, as many as are possible, are in a pool or in some sort of coalition government, where there are no obstructions, we could carry on faster. I don't personally, after my 25 years of experience, I would not say, doctor, that the party system has succeeded fully in this country, you see. I was one of the few in 1947. I was the only one in 1947 in the state council. At that time I formed the one-man opposition in the state council. In 1947, who opposed